comes to me a lot in this is how senses are emphasized.
Yes.
Transformed.
The divine senses, yes. And how Sri Aurobindo uses images of things that we can grasp to help us begin to imagine things that we can't grasp, beyond what tongue can utter and mind dream.
Shaman?
Yes. Who doesn't know? Savitri doesn't know?
I don't know.
No, this is referring to Savitri's experience.
Yeah.
So it's as if these are new ecstasies for her, something not experienced before. That's how I understand it. A clasp is an embrace. I take this to be the embrace of the divine. Or we could say of Krishna, since comes veilless love, no? But here, because of the limitation of our mortal nature, because of the limitations of matter, that clasp can't be seen and felt. It's only on these higher levels that it can be experienced. Was a visible tone of ecstasy, as if the color is expressing an ecstatic music. There are shapes that seem to be half immaterial, and yet they are touchable, voluptuously palpable. They can be felt and touched. So what they do is that they make the indwelling spirit sensible to touch. These forms seem half immaterial, but they can be touched. They make the indwelling spirit to be experienced by the touched. So all the senses, the high perfected sense, lived, illumined as a happy vassal of the inner ray. A vassal is a dependent and a servant. So this is a willing instrument. The sense is a willing instrument of the inner light of consciousness. Each feeling was the eternal's mighty child, and every thought was a sweet, burning god. Air was a luminous feeling, sound, a voice speaking with meaning, sunlight, the soul's vision, and moonlight, its dream, on a wide living base of wordless calm, all was a potent and a lucid joy. The whole experience is of power and light and delight. So she sees those higher levels and she rises up into them. Claude, you would read?
Into those high spirit when floating up, like an absorbing bird, the monks unseen, voicing to their sense with throbbing heart of melody. The pause of closing wind comes quivering in his last contemplative quiet, and he is silent with his soul distraught, delivered of his heart's burden of delight. Experience mounted on joyous, colored breath, to inaccessible sphere the spirit life. There time dwelt with eternity as one. Immense felicity joined what before.
No, we will pause there, thank you. It's a very beautiful simile of Savitri's spirit mounting up like a bird I wonder if any of you recognize this bird. Not a nightingale, but a lark. Oh, there's a chair at the back. There's a chair at the back. If you, you're happy here? Okay, good. We're on page 678. This is the little inconspicuous bird who, on summer mornings in Europe, rises up into the sky singing his heart out. And it's such a small, inconspicuous bird, you can't actually see him. You can only hear that he's spiraling up. And then there comes a point, he voices to the ascent his throbbing heart of melody, until a pause of closing wings comes quivering in his last contented cry. He stops singing when he gets to the very top, and he closes his wings and floats down again. He is silent with his soul discharged. He's expressed all the deep feelings of his heart. Poets love this bird, and many of them have written about him. But I think this is the most beautiful description of the lark that I have ever come across.
Do you know its name?
It's a lark.
Hark,
hark, the lark at heaven's gate sings. This is Shakespeare. And then there is Shelley also. But anyway. So her spirit is flying up like that into those heights above, those higher levels. He says, experience mounted on joy's colored breast, as if Savitri's spirit is a bird with a beautifully colored breast expressing delight, mounting up to inaccessible spheres, to realms that can't be reached, in a spiral flight. So those inaccessible spheres, he says, their time dwelt with eternity as one. It's the meeting point of timelessness and time. Immense felicity, joined, rapt repose. So there's something extremely calm and restful and peaceful about this intense delight.
Experiences?
Not clear to you? I think it's Savitri's experience as her soul, as her spirit goes floating up, she experiences that climbing.
I'm kind of wondering about, it's her body's being supramentalized with this experience.
I don't want to speculate about that. He said that her human nature feels faint with this intense delight, but certainly she's identified with her spirit as she moves up in her central being, in her consciousness. To us, all this might seem like the supramental experience, but I can't say anything about that. I can't.
He doesn't want to name it here.
Here he doesn't name it. No, he doesn't name it. So let's go on. Paula.
As one drowned in a sea of splendor and bliss, mute in the maze of these surprising worlds, turning, she saw their living knot and source, key to their charm, and fount of their delight, and knew him for the same who snares our lives, captured in his terrifying, pitiless net, and makes the universe his prison camp, and makes in his immense and vacant vasts the lure of the stars a circuit vain, and death the end of every human road, and grief and pain, the wages of man's toil. One whom her soul had faced as death and night, a sum of all sweetness, gathered into his limbs and blinded her heart to the beauty of the suns. Transfigured was the formidable shape, his darkness, and his sad, destroying might, abolishing forever and disclosing the mystery of his high and violent deeds. A secret splendor rose revealed to sight, where once the vast embodied void had stood. Night, the dim mask, had grown a wonderful face.
Thank you. Anybody would like to ask anything about this passage? A circuit vein. So it means we go round and round in circles and it doesn't seem to lead anywhere. So the stars, it's actually the stars. The stars are just turning in the universe. They're following their orbits, moving with the galaxies. What comes of all that?
Well, I didn't get it. I really didn't. I don't understand. Who are we talking about? What's the living knot and the source? And then it goes through this grief and pain and wages of toil.
You read it.
I know. I was faking.
So she says, when Savitri rises up into these highest worlds, she's drowned in a sea of splendor and bliss. She's silent, mute, she can't speak. In this maze, there's a labyrinth of surprising worlds. But she turns around, and there she sees the one, the being, who is the living knot and source of all these wonderful worlds, the key to their charm, the fount, the source of their delight. And she recognizes him as death, the one she has faced as death. He is the one who snares our lives in his terrifying, pitiless net. The net of death, of mortality. Mm-hmm. He's the one who makes the universe his prison camp. We can't escape from it, no? And makes, in his immense and vacant vast, in his huge empty spaces, this circuit of the stars. It may be so beautiful, but it seems to be meaningless, useless. No? And he's the one who makes death the end of every human road. And grief and pain are the wages of man's toil. We work so hard, we aim for all kinds of things that we think will make us happy, but we can't escape his net of grief and pain. One whom her soul had faced as death and night. She's battled with him through two whole books, no? We have followed her and this exchange, no? Now she sees him completely differently. He's gathered the sum of all sweetnesses into his limbs, into his appearance. It's become completely different. The beauty of what she sees blinded her heart to the beauty of the suns. Transfigured was that formidable shape that she has seen as death. His darkness and his sad destroying might, abolishing forever. She will never again be taken in by that darkness. And disclosing, revealing the mystery of his high and violent deeds. he's revealed to her sight as a secret splendor. And it's, he's standing in that same position where death had stood, no? Where once the vast embodied void, that embodiment of nothingness, night, that mask of darkness has grown a wonderful.
So to just transition from the previous bit, where we have this very elevated and, you know, and just glorious experience of the worlds and the possibilities and all.
Yes.
And then the next thing, you know, she turns around and there's this other transform. I mean, so what's the link between those states?
He said, he, this one now she sees, she recognizes him as the one she had faced as death and night, but now she sees that he's the living knot and source of all these wonderful worlds of everlasting day.
Sometimes take the shape she wants to show, that it is the shape of the awful man, and then now the glowing face that she's looking at.
And more descriptions of persons who, on the third of the head, turn there, and describe exactly these moments.
Three of you.
I think the imagery, of course, is vastly different there. Let us not forget Shiva, who is destruction and creation at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So here is, again, in another more beautiful, poetic way, kind of the same idea.
She's seeing what we could call God.
Yeah.
No? And she realizes that this is the true face of that one who has been challenging her in a very dark and terrifying form. That is why I consider that what we read through Book 9 and Book 10, the four long cantos of Book 10, these are, in a way, the way that the universe tests our spiritual realizations. She has gone through this amazing yoga and had such high realizations of the cosmic spirit and the cosmic consciousness. That's a preparation now for what she has to face when Satyavan is taken away from her. And there's a whole series of experiences. And I think if we looked at it carefully, we would see that each of those experiences with death has been testing a particular realization that she had in the course of Book 7. And now, as she's passed all those tests, but there's another set of tests to come. She's not yet able to unite with Satyavan. She's not yet able to bring him to earth with her. So now what is going to happen next?
For me, this understanding what you thought is here, that you can see the darkness, like also here to Arjuna, the visible side. But why is here that blinded her heart to the beauty of the suns?
He's so splendid, so glorious, that she can't even see the light of the suns anymore. She only sees his brightness. That's so dazzling and... well, it's a way of expressing how intense his beauty is. No, I have, of course, said something about that, that Yama is the figure of death who comes to take away Satyavan in the traditional legend. Sri Aurobindo never uses that word here, and he doesn't present the figure of death in the same way as he's presented in the legend. There we see him as Yama, He's the one who regulates things in the universe, keeps everything in its place, fulfills fate, but he's also the God of dharma, of correct, right action, right speech. And it is by the power of her correctness, the rightness of her speech, that Savitri overcomes him, so that he has to grant her boon. The way that Sri Aurobindo presents all this is completely different from that traditional legend. He says that shows the whole story as a story of conjugal love conquering death, and that the wife, by her devotion and love and chastity and correctness, can protect her husband. But he shows it in another way. He's showing it to us as a necessary event in the course of evolution for the conquest, eventually, the eventual conquest of ignorance and death, and the possibility of a divine life upon earth. That's only present in a very symbolic way in the Mahabharata legend. What Sri Aurobindo saw in the legend was a reflection of, he says, a much more ancient symbolic story. We can do this sometimes with the Greek myths. We see that the way that they have come to us must be a misunderstood, translated version of a much deeper and higher truth. And that's, we see some of these higher truths sometimes expressed, for example, in Russian fairy stories. Obviously, there were storytellers who went around from place to place. And if we look carefully at the symbolism of these stories in their original forms, not as they've come to us now after communism, but as they were told in the 19th century, they're telling these same truths. They're telling deep spiritual truths. So that something like that has happened. Sri Aurobindo was able to recognize it from his own experiences with the Vedas. And he has told the story in what he considers to be its original symbolic significance. So part of that is the great insight that's there in traditional Indian spirituality, that the divine is both terrifying and high and violent, and gathers the sum of all sweetness into his limbs, and that we have to accept these different aspects. We would like to think that God is loving and pure and good and all the rest of it. He can challenge us in dark faces also for our progress, for our growth. So that's what we see happening with Savitri. It's a bit of a shock and difficult for us to assimilate. Yes, Larry.
I think there's probably, different levels of significance to this symbolism, but I think one way to look at it, too, is that you can look at that in different ways, depending on how Dutchman it is.
Yes.
And it can seem like a terrible end to everything, or it can seem like a passageway, to the divine.
Yes.
Or,
a step towards immortality.
Yeah. So a lot of it depends on
how you look at it.
Perception, the way that we look at things. And so,
and
the Savitri now is seeing this, you know, like
in another way.
Positive view of death in some way.
But he still goes on refusing. He still says, no, he's not going to let her take Satyavan back so easily.
Yeah, there's more to this.
More to the thing.
Idea, but
You are absolutely right, of course, and that's what we've seen Savitri do, pass from this state of eternal night through the different twilights. And she saw and experienced those psychological states, but she kept absolutely steadfast in her aim, and that is what has carried her through. And that aim, if we look at it in its symbolic significance, it is to rescue the soul of humanity from the grip of ignorance and death.
Mm. So I often want to see what there's a prayer which is ending and sees the divine in all things. Right? It's yeah also the, say,
yes,
underlying challenge in all darkness to see the divine and then also to keep go forward.
Can you do it? I'm having difficulty here. Maybe you can hang it onto my shawl.
Yeah,
yeah, thank you.
Shadavan, shared this before, but I just feel moved to share this aphorism of Sri Aurobindo's.
Share it.
I feel it, sorry to say it. To feel and love the God of beauty and good in the ugly and the evil, and still yearn to heal it of its ugliness and its evil. This is true virtue and morality.
This is the true virtue and morality. Mm-hmm. To see the God of beauty and
good
in the ugly and the evil. And still to yearn in, he says something about in compassion, no?
Yes.
In utter compassion, to deliver it from its ugliness and evil.
It took me many decades to open and surrender to that.
Mm. Yeah.
But it was my rock. I wouldn't be here now.
Mm.
And I wouldn't have known about that if it weren't for the grace of getting a teacher.
Mm. Shall we go on? Yes, please.
Still not understanding completely what you explained about the Greek mythology, bringing spiritual truths from a deep source and then at a level.
Yes.
Illustration fairy tales.
Well,
and
it's the that's what he's done. Yes. If we look in his book, The Secret of the Veda, he explains how it came to him that all these stories, they have a surface meaning which was important for people at the time for their ritual worship and their understanding of how to progress. But he saw also that on a deeper level, all these things that are mentioned, bulls and cows and whatever, they are all psychological symbols. They are symbols of psychological states and condition and powers. And there's one chapter or essay there where he says that he believes this probably was a universal or global culture at one time on the earth. Not for everybody, this dual system, that there was something for the common people, and then there was a secret esoteric meaning that was understood by those who were capable of understanding it. And that's what I'm talking about, that when I look at the Greek myths of creation, I see some traces of this secret knowledge. And similarly in the Russian fairy tales. They're fairy tales, if you are children or even as adults, you can enjoy them as tales, but you can also glimpse something of the deep psychological truth that is there behind some of them.
From which it is in the end.
Hmm?
Written or taught.
Yes.
So it's lost.
Yes. Or that it's been passed on and some of the meaning has got misunderstood or distorted on the way, mm-hmm. but some traces of it are still there. You want to say something, Luba? No? I'm very fortunate that when I first came to Oroville, into my hands came a book that had some of these stories in their more or less original form. I've lost track of that book, but I consider it one of the great blessings to have had it. Hmm?
Even the name of the book?
The book, it was called Russian Fairy Tales, I think, or something like that. Yeah.
You said at 1 year in this discussion
yes.
that Kirti Muk, a demon,
yes.
yeah, was to eat up all demons.
Yeah.
And he did.
I told this story just a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
There was something about somebody eating themselves up. No? Mm-hmm. As if by himself to devour himself. Death. Mm? And that reminded me of the story of Kirti Muk, who was a demon who was formed, emanated by Shiva, to eat up the other demons. And he did. He ate them all up and he was still hungry because he'd been made to devour, to eat. So then he asked Shiva, "What do I do now?" And Shiva said, "Eat yourself." And, yeah. and then he did. He started at the tail and he ate himself up until there was only the mouth part. And Shiva was very impressed by his devotion and said that this face, this devouring face, should be placed on every Shiva temple at the entrance, and that everybody who wished to enter would have to pay homage to Kirti Muk. If they didn't do that, then they couldn't enter. I don't think it refers to this passage. It was to something at the end of Book 10.
I don't know why it's here.
Ah. So I don't know either. Sorry. Shall we go on? Do you feel ready to go on? It continues the description of this changed appearance of this god. A gentleman at the back there, would you read? Yes.
Immediate infinity, the swing whose doom had outlined from the terrible unknown. The obscure, disastrous figure of a god fled was the error that arms the hands of thee. And like it, the ignorant god whose hollow deeds had given to nothingness. Dreadful voice. As when before, the eye that wakes in sleep, it opened the somber binding of book. Illumined letterings are seen which kept a golden blaze of thought inscribed within. A marvelous form responded to her gaze, whose sweetness justified life's blindest pain. All nature's struggle was its easy price. The universe and its agony seem worthwhile.
Thank you. So that whole state of mind, that night state of mind, which had allowed the appearance of this figure of death in the form which Savitri first faced him, now that has vanished. That vague infinity was slain, it's destroyed. That gloom which had outlined from the terrible unknown, the obscure, disastrous figure of a god. This is confirming what Larry was saying, that this is a state of consciousness that has changed. No? Fled was the error that arms the hands of grief and lighted the ignorant gulf whose hollow deeps had given to nothingness a dreadful voice. And he gives this wonderful simile You might have had an experience like this in dream sometimes. He says, it's as if when you're dreaming, somebody gives you a book that has a black binding. But when you open the binding, when you open the book, it's full of wonderful pictures, golden illuminations. No? Illumined letterings are seen, which kept a golden blaze of thought inscribed within. So the binding is black and not very appealing, but when you open it, there's this secret splendor revealed. So in the same way, it's as if the figure of death has opened up and revealed to her this marvelous form whose sweetness justified life's blindest pain. All nature's struggle was its easy price. The universe and its agony seemed worthwhile. Many mystics have reported this experience of a revelation of something which justifies the entire history of the universe with whatever pain and agony has been involved. It's the easy price. Asvapati is described as having this experience in the beginning of Canto 5. And he sees, oh yes, it had to be like that. It's all just right. That's how it had to be. Amitoj.
As in the colored chalice of a flower, angel visible on music's waves, a lotus of light-colored ecstasy, took shape out of the tremulous heart of chalice. There was no more the torment under the star, the eagles hidden behind nature's mask. There was no more the dark pretense of truth, the cruel riches on love's altered face. Hate was the grip of a dreadful amorous pride, a ruthless life intent only to possess. As there replaced the sweet original God, forgetting the willful love that gave it birth, the passion to lock itself in and to be mine, it would swallow all in one moment shell, devouring
Thank you. This first sentence is just amazing. Calyx of a flower. As if it's formed by voices. The choric calyx of a flower. It's aerial, it's etheric, but it's visible on waves of music, vibrations. A lotus of light-petaled ecstasy took shape. She sees it forming out of the tremulous heart of things. The lotus, of course, is the symbol of the divine presence the divine presence. And one of its name is Pankajam. Pankajam. It's one of the Sanskrit names for the lotus. There are strings of names, but it means born from the mud. So that's one of its qualities. But this lotus, this visionary lotus, is being born out of the very heart of things. A combination of light and music, vibration, voices. The tremulous heart of things, the heart of things trembling with delight. So all that torment under the stars, all the agony, all the evil has just been abolished. It no longer exists. There was no more the dark pretense of hate, the cruel rictus on love's altered face. A rictus is an involuntary smile. It's a muscular spasm that makes you look as if you're smiling, but actually you're not smiling. And he says, hate is like that. And he says, hate is an illusion, it's a pretense. And then he describes in a way the truth of what hate is. Hate was seen as the grip of the struggle of a terrible form of love. A ruthless love that only wants to possess, an egoistic love, has here in our world replaced the sweet original God. It's forgotten the will to love that gave it birth, this passion, no? The passion to lock itself in and to unite. It's got distorted so that it wants to swallow up all into one lonely self, devouring the soul that it had made its own. And it wants to punish that one who doesn't want to be swallowed up. By suffering and annihilation pain, punishing the unwillingness to be one, anger with the refusals of the world, passionate to take, but knowing not how to give. It's just a little insertion here. Earlier in the poem, he's given us a wonderful description of love and even human love. Here he shows us the other face. But all this has been abolished. Death's somber cowl, this black hood that he's been wearing, is cast away from nature's brow. She no longer has to wear it anymore. And Savitri experiences the Godhead's lurking laugh. He's laughing at her. You thought I was like that. Yes.
In the Lashanda 1966, Mother described four levels of human love, but Israel is one. It's incredible. Alors, it's exactly the end of this passage, experience of the mother, about the love.
Thank you. Patty, would you go on?
Oh, grace and glory. And all divinity were here collected in a single fold. All worshipped eyes looked through his from one face. He bore all Godhead's grandiose dreams. An oceanic spirit dwelt within, intolerant and invincible in joy. A flood of freedom and transcendent bliss into immortal lines of continuous. In him, the fourfold being bore its crown that wears the mystery of a nameless name. The universe, writing its tremendous sense in the inexhaustible meaning of the word.
Thank you. So the beginning of the passage, relatively easy to understand, no? All grace and glory and all divinity were here collected in a single form. All worshipped eyes looked through his from one face. His through his. This being that she's seeing, he bore all Godheads in his grandiose limbs, all the individualized forms, faces of the divine. And within, she can feel this oceanic spirit, infinitely vast, dwelling within, which is intolerant and invincible in joy. It will only allow joy, nothing else. A flood of freedom and transcendent bliss into immortal lines of beauty rose. So in this one form, the fourfold being bore its crown. In the following passage, Sri Aurobindo is going to describe the four aspects of this fourfold being. The fourfold being that wears the mystery of a nameless name. The universe writing its tremendous sense in the inexhaustible meaning of a word. That word would be the nameless name, I suppose, which expresses the whole tremendous sense, the whole tremendous significance and meaning of the universe in a single word. Through this, it expressing this fourfold being. You would read next, please.
In him, the architect of the visible world, at once the art and artist of his works, spirit and seer and thinker of things seen, Virat, who lights his campfires in the suns, and the star-entangled ether is his goal, expressed himself with matter for his speech. Objects are his letters, forces are his words. Events are the crowded history of his life, and sea and land are the pages for his tale. Matter is his means and his spiritual sign. He hangs the thought upon a lash's lift, in the current of the blood makes flow the soul. His is the dumb will of atom and of clod, a will that without sense or motive acts, an intelligence needing not to think or plan. The world creates itself invincibly, for its body is the body of the Lord, and in its heart stands Virat, King of Kings.
Thank you. Anybody can tell me anything about this name, Virat?
Ask, no.
Hmm?
Ask.
Means
use,
vast.
Like in this epic, Krishna shows his form, the Virat form. Like everything is coming into him and going. He's referring to
this
first one out of the four.
He's the first one, yes. In Latin, this vir, it means strength, and it's in virtue, no? Also, quality. So I wondered if there was any,
it could mean
powerful, no?
It's brave and powerful.
Yes, so that suggestion also is here. Perhaps the vastness and the power.
I get a feeling of trying to go embrace opposites or see things that we normally, you know, the name and the nameless, the things that are seemingly opposite.
Yes. Sri Aurobindo often does this to us, bringing things together that seem contradictory, paradoxical. He says, in this way, thought buffeted wakes up and becomes alive. So we find it throughout Savitri. He's doing things like this. This nameless name. Yeah. But he says it's a mystery, it's a paradox. What is that nameless name? Can we think? We don't have a name for that namelessness. But if we had a name, then that would sum up the whole meaning of the universe. Brahman, can we say Brahman? Is that a nameless name? Yes, sorry, who wanted?
I want to tell, for example, when
For me, there is some inner aspect of Shrodinger.
Look at the characteristics that are described here. He seems to be the ruler of the material world. No? He's expressing himself with matter for his speech. Of course, he's spirit and seer and thinker, but thinker of things seen, the visible world. He lights his campfires in the suns of the material universe. And this star-entangled ether is his hold, under his control. So he expresses himself with matter for his speech, for his language. Objects are his letters. Forces, material forces, are his words. Events make up the crowded history of his life. And sea and land are the pages for his tale. That's where the events happen. Matter is his means and also his spiritual sign. He can do amazing things with matter. He hangs the thought upon a lash's lift. The lashes, the eyelashes, you know, just by making a little movement with your eyelashes, you can convey some meaning, you know, convey some thought. In the current of the blood, he makes flow the soul. His is the dumb will of atom and of clod. And then he tells us how that will gets expressed. It acts without any senses, without any motive, there's no intention, but there's an intelligence that doesn't need to think or to plan. So the world creates itself invincibly. Nothing can stop it because its body, the material universe, is the body of this Lord. And in its heart, there stands Virat, the one who is the master of the universal, the material universe, King of Kings. That's the first aspect which he speaks about.
Sir,
yes.
Is Virat also the form of change?
No. That changed form of death contains within it the fourfold being. And all worshipped eyes, whatever conceptions we might have about the Supreme, he is carrying all those within himself.
Virat is also called the Vishwarupa.
Ah, the Vishwarupa, the universal form, the universal body. Yes. Yes. So the other part, the other aspects which we'll read about next time are the golden child, the Hiranyagarbha, the Prajna, and Turiya. So these four are described in the following passage. Yes.
So, I think there you have the vastness or the royalty plus the heroism.
Yes.
King, you're supposed to be your...
Yes, have to be. Yeah. Yes.
Looking at the line 350.
Yes.
An intelligence needing not to think or plan, and the world creates itself invincibly. When that word comes planning, our planners are downward, not easy. That's why they are failing so badly. Maybe this is a problem of creation. We do not have to plan in the ordinary way. Maybe it will create things invincible by itself. I don't know.
You may be right. But we shouldn't. We are human beings. So it's not like the material world creating itself invincibly. It does that. because there's within it there's this secret intelligence. That secret intelligence expresses itself in us, in mind. And that's our problem, actually. So let's not go into that today, planning or no planning.
Yeah, I tend to go towards no planning.
No. Something will happen if you don't plan.
Yeah, that's what I love.
But it might not be the best possible thing. But of course, if you plan, it might not be the best possible thing either.
So we
are supposed to be opening up our minds. Mother has a beautiful message about that in connection with formation of ashram or the life of the ashram. She said, I'm quoting now, I don't know whether I get it completely right. Above the mind, there is a wisdom which sees more clearly than we can see. And in the heart of nature, there's a will which is stronger than any human will. Our task is to serve that wisdom and that will. That's the whole meaning of our lives, to serve the higher wisdom and that deep inherent will in nature, which is Sri Aurobindo tells, he's written The Life Divine to tell us that that will in nature is for the divine life in matter.
For that, we should not have any plans.
Sorry?
For that, we should not have any plans for that to come.
I don't want to say that. We should, of course, develop intuition. Then we can make plans. Mother planned a city. She wanted a city to happen. She's given quite clear indications of what she wanted to happen. So can we get that vision of hers and find out the best way humanly to try to implement it? That would be our task, and to offer our life energies and our physical capacities to help that to happen. But the first thing would be to open ourselves to that will, that wisdom and the will. The will implement itself invincibly anyway. But we could become willing instruments. I think that's what we're supposed to do, no?
Yeah,
willing servitors. Yeah. Can't just let everything go.
No, willing is correct.
Okay. Let's listen to Mother reading some of these passages.
Crown nature's sunlight is the soul's vision, and moonlight its day. Into those heights her spirit went floating up. ecstasy took shape out of the tremulous heart of things. This somber cow was cast from nature's brow. There lightened on her the Godhead's lurking love. All grace and glory and all divinity were here collected in a single form. All worship eyes looked through his from one face. He bore all Godhead in his grandeur.
Expressed himself with matter for his speech.